I guarantee everybody in Alaska will find something about this plan they don't particularly care for.
Governor Walker releases his plan for balancing the state budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 9th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Senator Lisa Murkowski works to toss out parts of No Child Left Behind.
Once you've identified the problem, you can't assume that there is a one-size-fits-all solution.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This morning, Governor Bill Walker released his plan for dealing with the state's mammoth budget deficit. It includes Alaska's first income tax since 1980 and a complete overhaul of how the state uses the permanent fund, effectively cutting PFD checks in half next year, APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Well, welcome. Good morning. Thank you all so much for being here.
Governor Bill Walker announced his budget standing in a hangar owned by the transit and logistics company Linden, joined by mayors, business and labor leaders, and flanked by his grandson on one side, and on the other, a large cardboard chart that read, "Doing nothing is irresponsible." And this plan could not be accused of doing nothing.
I guarantee everybody in Alaska will find something about this plan they don't particularly care for.
The plan includes a state income tax. It would be the first since Alaska abolished its income tax after the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It also raises taxes on mining, fishing, and tourism, on alcohol and tobacco, and on fuels for cars and trucks, boats and planes. And it would do away with the state's expensive system of tax credits for oil and gas producers, replacing it with a loan fund. But the governor argued that the state has no choice. With oil prices hovering around $40 a barrel, Alaska is facing a deficit of $3.4 billion next year and into the foreseeable future.
There is no perfect plan other than the plan that gets done, other than the plan that makes this change. The worst plan is that plan. The plan of doing nothing and continuing on the course that we're on.
Walker's team says the proposal aims to spread the burden of state operations as widely as possible and avoid drastic cuts to state services. The most radical change would be what the governor calls a replumbing of state finances. The administration wants to redirect oil and gas taxes into the permanent fund and then transform the fund into a kind of endowment, using its earnings as a steady stream of revenue for state government. The goal, Walker says, is to get Alaska off the boom and bust cycle of oil prices and ensure a stable source of income in the face of declining oil production. He called it putting the state on an allowance.
What we're looking for is not just a balanced budget and say this year we have a balanced budget. We need a sustainable budget.
But of course, right now, the permanent fund earnings go into PFD checks. Walker's plan would change that, funding dividends with royalties from resource development. That change would cut PFD checks in half next year, from an estimated $2,000 under the current system to about $1,000. But the governor's team argues that at current rates, the state will burn through its available savings within the decade, putting future dividends at risk. Lawmakers received the plan cautiously. Eagle River Republican Anna McKinnon is co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee.
I think the governor is putting all things on the table. I was thinking about what is the saying? Everything was there except the kitchen sink. I don't know if we're taxing the kitchen sink or not, but everything was there. So there is something for everyone to hate. And I think that the governor will have to prioritize these requests.
McKinnon says she's open to the governor's proposals, but the devil is in the details. And she says the governor hasn't proposed enough cuts to justify the new taxes. In all, Walker is proposing about $100 million in new cuts and $360 million in new taxes, plus phasing out $500 million in tax credits available to the oil and gas industry.
I don't need $500 million from a personal level or $1 billion in 1 year, but I do need a plan that right-sizes and prioritizes government, working with communities and cities to do that.
Senate Minority Leader Berta Gardner, an Anchorage Democrat, says her caucus is also open to the governor's ideas.
I guess I want to express my gratitude that he's taking the lead on this. because I think he's absolutely right that we cannot wait.
Gardner says Democrats don't love the idea of cuts to the PFD, and she'd like to see the minimum oil tax raised higher. The governor's plan would increase it from 4% to 5%. But at the end of the day, she says the state needs something similar to Walker's proposal. Even if oil climbs back above $100 per barrel, Alaska still faces the prospect of declining production.
The investment earnings now are greater than our earnings from oil and gas. And that's our new reality, and I don't see that changing.
The governor's plan is just the first move in the budget cycle. Lawmakers will have a chance to make their own proposals when the regular legislative session begins in January. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
So what do Alaskans think about the budget proposal? We sent reporters out around the state to check on two of the biggest potential changes, a state income tax and a smaller PFD. Here's an unscientific sample of what we heard.
I'm an elder. I remember when the permanent fund was created, when Jay Hammond did it years ago. And at the time, it was talked about that this was going to be our rainy day fund because someday the pipeline wasn't going to be carrying all this oil and we were going to run out of money. And at that time, we would have all these savings and we would use them for state government.
No, I'm just we're looking at some tough times, and much rather see our investment in the oil industry dividends take care of it than have to impose taxes on people.
I'm not for a state income tax. At all.
It wouldn't affect me financially, but I'm opposed to the state taking any more PFD or anything, taking any portion of the PFD. They need to keep their hands off of that and look at taxes first.
But I also think we need to have a sales tax to capture the dollars being spent in the state, from tourism and whatnot. So I don't think an income tax alone is going to help.
Well, of course I don't want a state income tax, but I want to live in a state that has health and education and parks and harbors. So if we have to have a state income tax, I think we're going to have to, and I think we're going to have a smaller permanent fund.
If I'm going to say that income tax is okay, I sort of have to say it's okay to have a lesser PFD check, because it's sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul, getting a PFD check. So I'd be okay with no PFD check if it meant that our state could run.
Once they start tapping into our permanent fund, who's to say they're not going to pilfer the money from the permanent fund into their agenda and their budget?
The governor and the legislature are better informed about the financial situation of the state than I am, So I would do whatever has to be done. I know the state of Alaska is in a bind big time.
That was Darlene Crawford in Anchorage, Robert Johnson and Rose Shemansky in Wrangell, Denise Robinson and Mike Holman in Unalaska, Ellen Frankenstein and Amy Sweeney in Sitka, Rick Siraku from Ketchikan, and Bert Maupin in Anchorage. They were weighing in on Governor Walker's budget proposal that includes a state income tax and a smaller permanent fund dividend. The Senate today passed an education bill, and the president is expected to sign it tomorrow. Both Alaska senators voted for it, as did Congressman Don Young in the House. But many lawmakers say they're happy to dump No Child Left Behind. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the new education bill leaves in place major elements of the law, and that may not be a terrible thing.
Before No Child Left Behind, school districts didn't really have to come clean about their failures. Bad schools were just swept under the rug, hidden among the averages. Senator Lisa Murkowski is a big critic of the 2001 law, but she says the law's mandated tests did produce important data on specific schools and populations.
No Child Left Behind, for all of its warts, for all of its problems, what it did deliver to us was a level of accountability.
In her pre-Senate days, her own son's school, Government Hill Elementary in Anchorage, was labeled a failing school at first. Murkowski says it was devastating to the parents and the neighborhood. The problem, she says, is that too few students from a small subcategory showed up on test day. But Murkowski says the bigger Alaska picture was disturbing.
It was pretty tough to take to see that in many of our rural schools, to see that so many of our Alaska Native students were being left behind, it caused us to look critically at how we were providing for that level of education. That was important.
Trouble is, Murkowski says, after the law found the weak spots, it also dictated how to fix them with mandates from Washington.
Once you've identified the problem, you can't assume that there is a one-size-fits-all solution.
What works in New York City or even Anchorage might not work in rural Alaska. For instance, Murkowski says, one common Washington mandate for a failing school is to fire the principal.
Well, what happens if you are a small school in a rural area? Let's just pick a community like Kobuk. Might not be easy to get a principal out into the school there in Kobuk, and it might not be the principal that can fix it.
Murkowski was on the House Senate Conference Committee that wrote the final bill. Senator Lamar Alexander, a Tennessee Republican, was one of the main authors. He said on the Senate floor he thought he wanted to get rid of a much-despised hallmark of No Child Left Behind, the federal test. In the end, Alexander concluded the problem wasn't the tests, but that No Child Left Behind put too much emphasis on them.
The results of these tests count so much in the federally mandated accountability system that states and school districts are giving students dozens of additional tests to prepare for the federal tests.
The new law lets states and school districts decide how much weight to give the tests. It has states setting their own standards and saying when and how to intervene if schools don't meet them. The legislation also includes $1 million annual grant program for native language immersion schools, authored in part by Murkowski. And it has money for sexual abuse education in states like Alaska that have passed bills known as Aaron's Law. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering at the Baskin elder Sidney Huntington.
You know, on his deathbed this past couple of weeks, had said that he did the best he could with a third grade education and that he wanted people to know that.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
Fort Wainwright has settled alleged violations of its hazardous waste permit for $60,000. The Environmental Protection Agency says the Army failed to report an abandoned ammunition dump. KUAC's Robert Hannon reports.
For 25 years, Fort Wainwright has been on the books as a Superfund site. EPA officials say it's not uncommon for Army posts to have areas where there are buried munitions and unexploded ordnances. Many may not even be documented. That was the case in 2013 when a new explosives dump was discovered at the Army's Small Arms Range Complex. The Army is supposed to report that sort of discovery within 15 days, says Susanna Skidowski with the EPA. But that didn't happen.
We learned about the discovery of the munitions dump a year later when we received a technical memo from one of the Army's contractors at the site.
Skidowski says the fines for not reporting could have cost the Army more than $30 million, but the EPA sees the incident more as an oversight. With roughly 1 million acres, Fort Wainwright has a lot of territory where surprises may lurk, and Skidowski says the Army was cleaning up the site.
Site might be used as a dump, covered up, and then forgotten about or just, you know, not followed up on. So that's what happened here.
Skidowski says this year some 320,000 pounds of material have been removed from Fort Wainwright, but more work needs to be done. Officials at Fort Wainwright were not available for comment by press time. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
A substitute village police officer from the dry village of Selawik is in jail in Nome awaiting trial. Brent Norton is charged with supplying alcohol to a minor and having sex with her while she was unconscious. 1 month earlier, Norton received an award at AFN for his dedication to public safety. His case brings up important questions about how VPOs are vetted in villages throughout the state. KNOM's Emily Russell has the story.
On October 17th, Brent Norton, a substitute village police officer from Selawik, was presented with a President's Award at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage. Norton was recognized for his response to a shooting in Selawik this summer. At that time, he had less than 6 months of experience, but was first on the scene. While the victim died from gunshot wounds, Norton risked being shot at to retrieve the body.
The Glenn Godfrey Law Enforcement Award is given to Alaska Native Law Enforcement Officer who has shown outstanding dedication to the safety of the public in Alaska. The Glenn Godfrey Law Enforcement Award goes to Putnamu Brent James Norton from Selawik.
The Alaska Federation of Natives had no comment on Norton's award. 1 month later, 29-year-old Norton allegedly supplied a 16-year-old girl, Lois Cleveland, with alcohol and later had sex with her while she was unconscious. According to an article published by the Arctic Sounder, the Selawik Clinic received a call from Norton just before 1 a.m. on November 18th. Norton described Cleveland as cold and not breathing. Emergency responders spent 20 minutes trying to resuscitate her before she was declared dead. Norton's record was far from clean prior to this year. In 2006, Norton was arrested and pled guilty for transporting alcohol to a dry village. He was arrested for the same charge again in 2012. Then in February of this year, he was arrested and pled guilty for giving alcohol to a 13-year-old girl. So how did a man with a record for importing and supplying alcohol to minors get hired as a substitute VPO in the dry village of Selawik? Chris Hatch, a program coordinator for village public safety officers in the Northwest Arctic Borough, explains.
According to Alaska statute, only a village can hire a village police officer. They're the only ones who can hire a VPO.
To be clear, a VPSO, which is what Hatch oversees, is different in many ways from a VPO. A VPSO goes through extensive training and vetting compared to what a VPO is put through. But there are some safeguards in place. According to the Alaska statutes, a person with misdemeanor convictions in the last 10 years will be, quote, judged on his or her moral character at the council's discretion. A person convicted of a felony in the last 10 years is ineligible. The incident in February of this year in which Norton supplied alcohol to a minor was a Class C felony. But he was a substitute VPO, so under even less scrutiny. Hatch again.
So what happens in a lot of communities is they hire a VPO, and then they'll hire someone to fill in. So you have a guy who works, you know, 20 hours a week, 30 hours a week, whatever the particular community wants. But when he leaves for some reason, they have someone to fill in for him. In this case, they're calling him a substitute VPO.
While VPOs must pass a background check, the hiring of substitutes is at the discretion of the village. The city of Selawik had no comment for this story. And according to his introduction at this year's AFN convention, Norton's reputation outshone his record.
Residents describe him as a dedicated to helping, and he is known for his courteousness and kindness. He is an example of responsibility, courage, and respect.
Norton's involvement in the death of Selawik teen Lois Cleveland will add another felony to his record if he's convicted. He's being held at the Anvil Mountain Correctional Center in Nome with bail set at $50,000. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
The Anchorage Assembly is requesting an official audit after a review surfaced alleging financial mismanagement in the city's centennial celebration. Assemblymember Bill Starr of Eagle River chairs the audit committee. He asked to delay paying $69,000 from the city's general fund for outstanding bills related to the centennial last summer. A review of contracts handled under the Sullivan administration, first reported by KTUU News, shows about $100,000 in unpaid centennial expenses with vendors like the Alaska Aces, the Downtown Partnership, and Alaska Railroad Corporation, among others. The review was requested by the Berkowitz administration. Now Star is requesting an official report from the city's independent auditor.
I'm not going to say that I'll ask the question slightly different, but we may have a different motivation in play.
Star says the point of an official audit is twofold. First, making sure vendors get paid the money they're owed, and second, looking back in detail over the recent findings on misallocated funds, improper financial transactions, and poor oversight of contracts. Star and others say it doesn't appear anything illegal happened, but that city procedures for handling public money may have been poorly followed.
We had certain expectations on how the money was going to be spent in the celebration aspect of the centennial. I don't think there's anybody making accusations that it was inappropriately spent, perhaps, but it also needs to bear truth that we did good accountability and we tried to deliver the best products we could.
Star also hopes an audit will turn up other funding sources like matching grants originally offered by private companies that may lessen how much the municipality has to pay.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
Sidney C. Huntington passed away yesterday in Galena. He was 100 years old. Huntington was an expert trapper, fisherman, boat builder, and carpenter in the Middle Yukon and Koyukuk Valleys of the interior. He went on to serve 17 years on the Board of Game during the 70s and 80s and ran a successful fish processing business out of Galena for many years. In his later years, Huntington became a strong advocate for public education in rural Alaska, helping to found an independent school district for Galena in the early 1970s. His daughter, Agnes Sweetser, says promoting education for the bush should be his lasting legacy.
You know, on his deathbed this past couple of weeks, had said that he did the best he could with a third grade education and that he wanted people to know that was important to him.
Huntington's life is immortalized in the popular biography Shadows on the Koyukuk. Huntington was also well known for a serious work ethic and denouncing government assistance programs. Those beliefs rubbed off on many of Huntington's family and friends, including daughter Betty Huntington.
He taught us to work hard, and I always talk about that. You know, people always laugh that I'm still at work 10 minutes early and leaving late. And that was just the way he was.
Sidney Huntington is survived by his wife of 72 years, Angela. He raised roughly 30 biological and adopted children. Funeral services will be held in Galena this weekend. Sidney Huntington leaves behind not only a long list of accomplishments, but an entire philosophy of life. After 12 years of living in the shadow of Huntington in Galena, KIYU's Tim Bodoni has taken much of that philosophy to heart and shares this remembrance.
Sidney's biography could go on for hours. His story is so intertwined with the story of Alaska over the past 100 years. His dad came to the territory of Alaska in the Klondike Gold Rush. He watched the villages of the Middle Yukon and Lower Koyukuk Valleys transition from isolated subsistence-based settlements to communities with satellite dishes, snow machines, and multi-million-dollar schools. But like the villages themselves, Sidney never abandoned subsistence. As he explained in a 1996 interview for the oral history series Raven's Story, Sidney took pride in living close to the land even after his trapping days were over.
The change of life is dramatic. For me to say that I have changed very much, I imagine I have to quite a degree to keep up with time. But my variety of food and what I do has not changed very dramatically, only I have adapted myself to the new methods of ways to harvest wildlife resources and I have a deep respect, probably a deeper respect for wildlife resources than I think anybody in the country.
Never lacking in confidence, Sidney did many different kinds of work in his life: hunting, fishing, trapping, boat building, carpentry, mining, and fish processing, just to name a few. He served on the Board of Game for 17 years and helped create predator control programs and controlled use areas to protect moose populations in the interior. He had a huge family. He leaves a legacy in Galena not only in terms of what he did, but how he did it. Sidney insisted on the value of hard work and despised government handouts. He was legendary for starting his work early in the morning, working late into the night, and doing it all again the next day. Though he had only a third grade education, he was a strong supporter for public education in rural Alaska. Someone else in his position might say, "You don't need to go to school. I only went through the third grade. Look at me now." But he took the opposite approach. He wanted rural kids to have the formal education that he never had. He loved meeting students at Galena's boarding school and considered himself a father to all of them. The Galena K-12 school is already named after him and has been for 10 years. But what I think is the most interesting legacy that Sidney Huntington leaves behind is the new Alaska identity that he forged. He was half Alaska Native and half white, and didn't consider himself a full member of either of those camps. He drew lessons from books, boarding schools, and Native elders alike to build a lifestyle based on practicality, preparation, and respect. Each of those values is on display in this outtake from Raven's story, in which he describes his wolf trapping techniques.
"I wouldn't tell anybody how to trap wolves. That's not the historic way of doing it. They say you give your luck away and you can't catch them anymore, but I'm about over the hill now anyway, so it doesn't make it much difference. I generally trap on glare ice. And wolf trapping, I found, is a lot of work, dedicated work. You're trapping a very cautious, wary animal. The only thing that gets him is he's like you and I. He likes to know what's on the other side of the fence."
Clever, iconoclastic, and ultimately practical. That was Sidney Huntington. And of course, Sidney left us his book, Shadows on the Kaikuk. It's become more of a reference book than a biography at my house, and I try to reread it every year. It never ceases to be a fascinating look back at how Alaska used to be, but also an inspiration to the challenges that lie ahead of us. I never managed to have Sidney autograph it, but we have a table he built in our cabin, and that seems good enough. In Galena, I'm Tim Bodoni.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Emily Kwonk in Sitka, Katarina Sostarik in Wrangell, Greta Mart in Unalaska, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Emily Russell in Nome, and Tim Bodoni in Galena. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Increase the earning power with a Bachelor of Business Administration degree with a Human Resource Management emphasis from the UAS School of Management. Details at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.